Welcome to Baseball Biz on Deck. I am Mark Garbage, your host, and today let's take a quick look at women in baseball. If you blinked, you missed Women's Baseball Week during everything going on with the trade deadlines and the launching of the NFL preseason. But Women in Baseball Week comes from the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And today we have a very special guest, an author, Mary Fiddler, who has written about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And she'll share some tales and the history of that game and what's happening now with women in baseball. Mary Fiddler, glad to have you here today.
Glad to be here.
Mary, when I look at you and what you've had done with tracking All-American Girls Professional Baseball, this isn't something new for you. This is something that's been, you started early on in life, like with even with a thesis, didn't you?
Back in 1971, I was working on a master's degree at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And it was at the time one of the few universities that had a sport history master's degree program. That appealed to me because I was never strong in math, and so the scientific track wasn't all that appealing. One of the classes that was offered was Women in Sport in America. And for that assignment, or for that class, one of the assignments was to go through, of course, this was way before computers, was to go through Reader's Guide to Periodic Literature and find all the articles we could find about women in sport. And so I stayed in Massachusetts that Christmas vacation to do that project because I was working full-time as an intramural sports director at the university.
Oh, wow.
And in the process of doing that, I ran across a 1943 Time magazine article about Philip Wrigley starting a women's professional softball league. And I had grown up with a father and two brothers who were avid baseball fans, avid Yankee fans, and also played baseball in the local city team in a little town called Dungemere, California. Well, we spent every Sunday afternoon in one little town ballpark or another. And of course, I was rooting for my dad and my brothers, thinking about, well, one day I was going to be playing baseball in those parks. Well, as I grew up, I realized that at that time, girls couldn't play baseball. But I went into softball, and I had played softball interscholastically and intercollegiately and in recreation departments until I was almost 40. And I had never heard of this. Well, I wasn't 40 at that time, but at the time that I was doing this work, I hadn't ever heard of a professional softball league. And I knew about Philip Wrigley because, you know, they played the Yankees on occasion, or the Cubs did. So I asked one of my friends who was in the sport history master's degree or PhD degree program how I could find out more about this league. And he said, well, why don't you write to the League City sports editors and see if there's anyone who remembers anything about the teams? Remember, the league had folded in 54, and this was 1971. And so I did. And bless his heart, Joe Boland, who was sports editor of the South Bend Tribune, South Bend, Indiana Tribune, he had started out as a scorekeeper for the South Bend Blue Sox and had worked up to becoming one of their directors.
Wow.
And he wrote me back and he said, well, what you need to do is contact Gene Fout, who was probably the top, one of the top, if not the top, overhand pitcher in the league. She still lived in South Bend and worked in at the University of Notre Dame. So I contacted her and asked if I could stop and interview her on the way home from Christmas vacation, or the little bit of Christmas vacation that I got. She said yes, that I could do that. And so I did that. I flew to Chicago and rented a car and drove to South Bend and got a hotel room. And I was planning to be there for a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Jean Fout was a gold mine. She talked with me, and then on Friday when I got there, and then on Saturday she invited a couple of former players, a former manager, a former chaperone, and a former business manager of the South Bend Blue Sox for me to interview.
Oh my
and
gosh,
we had
Mary.
A great time talking around a table in her house. The manager was Chet Grant. He had played football at Notre Dame, and he was working in the sports and games collection at the university. And he said, well, why don't you come over to the university? I have some articles I wrote about the league, and I have some memorabilia and things. And so the next day I met him over there. And we talked about a lot about the team and Gene and various things. And he says, well, you know, what you really need to do is contact Arthur Meyerhoff. And Arthur Meyerhoff had been Wrigley's advertising agent that helped him start the league. And then in 1945, he bought the league from Wrigley and acted as league commissioner through the 1950 season. And his expertise, of course, was publicity and promotion. And he was who really publicized the league nationally and internationally, really helped keep it going in the league cities during those years. So when I got back to Massachusetts, I contacted him. Chet had given me his contact information. I said, well, could I come and interview you over Easter vacation the following spring? And he said, sure, I'll be at my San Diego home. And so I did that. I flew to San Francisco. My mom met me, and we drove down to Mr. Meyerhoff's home near San Diego. And he was very gracious, and we had a good interview. Toward the end of the interview, he said, well, what you really need to do is go to my Chicago office in the Wrigley building and go through my All-American League files, which were stored in the basement of the Wrigley building. And I wasn't able to do it that summer, but the following summer, I went to Chicago. I spent a week of 8-hour days sitting at his desk, going through his files that his secretaries brought up from the basement of the Wrigley building.
That must have been fascinating to have that history in your hands.
It was just incredible. And his secretaries would make copies of things that I wanted, or if there were extra copies, they said, sure, fine, take a copy. And then the other thing that Jean Fout had that I was able to get from her on that visit were 9 3-inch wide binders of league and team board meeting minutes, newspaper clippings, pictures.
Oh my gosh.
Letters, just all kinds of stuff.
True treasure trove.
And I looked at those and I said, Gene, there's no way I can go through these in a weekend. Would you let me take them with me? And bless her heart, you know, she didn't know me from Adam. But she trusted me to take those with me. Well, it took me with the Meyerhoff files and those records that Gene had were former president's files, the Dr. Daly, Harold Daly files. I spent 4 years going through all of that stuff and cataloging it and putting it in topics and finally writing it. Part of the problem was I was working full-time. But the one summer, I was able to use a friend's pre-computer. It was called a Selectric typewriter.
Oh, yeah.
Which let you make corrections from the keyboard. It had a little correction tape thing. Let you make corrections from the keyboard. I spent the whole summer finishing my thesis, and I finished it just before the fall semester of 1976. My dad had a bad heart attack at that point, and so I left Massachusetts and Oh, actually, I was at Pennsylvania at the time. I'd gone to Penn State to work on a doctorate in sport history. I went home and I wound up getting a high school teaching position, teaching English and PE. PE had been my major, and so, and coaching. But every once in a while, somebody would, one of the players would contact me and say, could I get a copy of your thesis? And one day, June Pepis, who had played for the Michigan teams, she lived in Michigan, and she said, and her business was printing. And she said, could I make some copies of your thesis to share with some of the other team members and or other league members? And I said, sure. Well, June got in her head that it would be nice to have a reunion, a players' reunion. And so she developed a newsletter and started getting addresses through people she knew, and then more addresses through people they knew and where they were and what their contact information was. And so that was the beginning of the first national reunions that the players had. And after that reunion, it was held in Chicago in July of 1982. And after that reunion, pockets of players starting having little reunions. There was a group in the Boston area, a group in the Midwest, of course, a group in the LA area, some in the Carolinas. The group in the Midwest was mostly based in Michigan and Indiana, and some from Illinois. They learned that one of the gals, one of the non-players who had been coming to their reunions, had gone to the Hall of Fame to find out more about the league. And she found that the Hall of Fame didn't have anything about the All-Americans.
Ooh, you know, I mean, let me stop for just a minute because I'm trying to figure this in my mind. Because the league was from like the 40s to mid 50s,
right?
And then it sounds like basically American history just turned its back on it. Had no way it's there, and you, a person, you know, an athlete yourself and a coach. You, I won't say you fell across it, but I mean, it wasn't something that popped right up. You know, so what happens then? So then it's, you're talking about now in the 1980s, and these people who were playing with a league that was 30 years ago, they're just now starting to come together. That must have made for some very interesting conversations.
Well, you know, that by that time, most of them had raised their families and retired. And they had time on their hands. So anyhow, this group in Michigan, Indiana decided that they wanted to be recognized. They wanted the league to be recognized for the Baseball Hall of Fame. So they started petitioning the Hall of Fame to include them as part of baseball history. And I won't go into the details, but in the fall of 87, the players incorporated so that they could collect memorabilia to give to the Hall of Fame. And in the fall of 1988, November of 1988, the Hall of Fame opened its first Women in Baseball exhibit. And they said that there were so many people that came to it that it was like going to an induction in the summertime.
Oh, wow.
They couldn't believe how many people came to it. In the meantime, in the fall of 87, one of the player's sons, Kelly Kandel, and his girlfriend, Kim, decided to do a documentary of the league, and they named it A League of Their Own. Aired on PBS TV, and one of Penny Marshall's aides saw it. And I don't know if you know, Penny Marshall was a rabid Yankees fan, too.
Boo. I'm just kidding.
She came to the opening of the Women in Baseball exhibit at the Hall of Fame wearing a baseball hat and dark glasses. It was there, talking to players and listening and that sort of thing, that she decided she wanted to do a movie about the league. She was able to get in a position to direct A League of Their Own, which hit theaters in the July of 1992. And it became one of the best baseball movies in history and is the highest grossing baseball movie in history. There were some little pockets of women in baseball, playing baseball in those Midwest towns and some in the Northeast, but they weren't real organized. But after the movie came out, more girls decided they wanted to play baseball. And then when Title IX passed and the first Little League girl to sue Little League to let girls play baseball, you know, those things all came together. The groups of women, girls and women who were playing baseball in the country expanded. San Francisco had a group for a while. LA has a group. I think there's a group in Florida. There's a group in Boston and Detroit area. Last November, one of the former players, her name is Susa Pay, who lives in Sarasota. She's also a Players Association board member. She has made it her objective to try to start a new professional league of their own. She organized a women's classic baseball tournament. She had four teams. She named them after the first four teams in the All-American League.
I love it.
And their jerseys were the same colors as the colors of the first four teams. I was there, and I was very impressed with the caliber of play.
Wow.
So there's going to be another tournament at the Orioles Stadium in Sarasota this November, November 17th through 19th, with the four teams. So anybody who lives in that area, put those dates on your calendar and go see those gals play.
I'll make sure I put that in the notes of the podcast as well. Thank you for that.
Yeah. One of my personal things is because it was what Wrigley and Meyerhoff did is they shortened the base paths and the pitching distance for the girls the first season, but they were longer than softball. And at that time, softball only had 10 players and the league only had 9 players. And Wrigley felt that baseball was a better spectator sport than softball. And he had the winning regional men's and women's softball teams play in his park in Chicago. And also at that time, he had a park in LA. So he knew women's softball was well-skilled, highly skilled. And in the fall of 1942, War Department contacted all of the major league owners and told them not to plan to have baseball in 1943 because there was going to be a big manpower push and that they felt that the population of the country would not look kindly on guys being able to stay home to play baseball when their sons and daughters were going off to the war. And so that's when Wrigley decided to organize the girls' baseball. Actually, he called it softball to begin with, but by mid-season, he renamed it All-American Girls Baseball League because the rules that he started with were baseball rules. And the only differences between the girls' game and regulation baseball at that time was that the baselines were shorter, pitching distance was shorter, and they used the large softball rather than the baseball, because that's what his talent pool was familiar with. And baseball rules don't stipulate how the ball has to be delivered. So they stayed with the underhand pitch, except that every year they lengthened the base paths a little bit and the pitching distance a little bit. Till by 1948, they decided to go to overhand pitching, be better with the distance of the base paths and the pitching distance. As the underhand pitchers weren't doing very well pitching at 55 feet or 52 feet, probably in 1948.
Yeah, you know, I look at that and I've tried to do a transposition into Major League Baseball. And when you were mentioning the uniforms earlier, I cannot imagine some of these people who are stealing bases and sliding in the base and having their legs exposed. And I mean, good Lord, the scrapes, the bruises,
Yeah, those gals were tough, I'll tell you. And they did. I have pictures of like floor burns on their thighs from sliding into base.
And there was tenacity and toughness from some of the videos I've seen. I mean, yeah, there's collisions sometimes.
You
don't get to own that home plate, Mrs. Catcher. You know, there's somebody coming in and bam. I wanted to talk to you too briefly because you mentioned the South Bend Blue Sox. And I occasionally get to work down at the Tampa Baseball Museum. And I guess the whole thing, there was one part featured about Shushu Worth, who's actually from the Ybor area. And that kind of stimulated my mind onto this because I hadn't thought about this, I guess, since that movie came out. And I certainly hadn't thought about it before. But now with conversation with you and with what Ms. Sue's doing in Sarasota, those sort of things, I think, bring it back to life for a lot of people. Can you tell me, though, a little bit about, do you know much about, like, Shushu?
One thing, and this was Wrigley's pet peeve, was that Major League Baseball didn't do very much, if anything at all, to make competition equitable among the teams. And so when he organized the All-American League, he stipulated that the player contracts were made with the league, not with the individual team directors. Okay. So every spring, they had a mutual spring training. All teams would go to one site, the managers and league officers would run the gals through drills. And this was especially true the first season. And they appointed players to teams based on their skill to try to equalize the competitive skill of each team so that no team would be way down in the cellar at the end of the season or way up at the top at the end of the season.
MLB needs to take a page from that thought.
Yeah. And then as time went on, of course, the teams were allowed to keep a nucleus of players. And as rookies came in and all, they, during the spring training, they would evaluate them and assign them to teams according to skill level, again, trying to keep the skill level as close as possible so that all teams would be competitive throughout the season.
Right.
It was really good in theory, and it worked a little bit, but it didn't account for injuries, illnesses, players having to leave because of family problems, that sort of thing. But they also had a system where a team could loan a player to another team for a short period of time, like if that player was sitting on the bench and could help out a team that needed a first baseman, they'd go and play first baseman for the other team until the original first baseman was able to come back, if at all. And if not, then they stayed with that team for the rest of the season.
Wow.
So it was interesting. And getting back to your question, one of the spring trainings was held in Havana, Cuba, and that was 1947. And that was the year that the Dodgers held spring training in Cuba because of Jackie Robinson.
Right.
They didn't want to take him to the South where they knew he'd be discriminated against. And so they went to a spring training in Cuba. And I don't know if you know this, but Branch Rickey was one of the three trustees to start the league. It was Wrigley, Rickey, and Wrigley's lawyer. I can't think of his name at the moment, but those three were the first trustees of the league. And they ran the league on a nonprofit basis because of the war. But anyway, this spring training in Cuba, it was started to be organized in the fall winter of 1946 because there was a gentleman in Cuba who organized a group of girls, baseball players. They played in the streets with the boys, just like most of the All-American players grew up doing. They had uniforms made that were very similar to the All-American uniforms, except that instead of it being a one-piece dress uniform, it was a shirt and a short skirt. Anyway, when the All-Americans went there, they played at Grand Stadium in Havana and drew large crowds in the thousands, 15,000, 16,000.
Wow.
Fans. The Cuban men were intrigued with women baseball players in short skirts. Not only that, but they were good players, good right. baseball players. They put on a good show. Well, from that event in 1948, there were three or four Cuban players that came to the U.S. to play with the All-American teams. And Shushu, being of Spanish descent and speaking Spanish, could communicate with them or help them communicate with the managers and that sort of thing. Shushu wasn't Cuban, but she was a link to the Cubans, and she was a very good player. I believe she was picked as an all-star either her rookie year or her sophomore year.
I saw she played shortstop, and you don't get that position unless you're able to be a good athlete and handle the game.
Yeah. And then what the teams would do after spring training, they pair up, have two teams on a bus, and they drive back to their home cities and stop and play exhibition games along the way. And that was one way of promoting the league, advertising it, and also they used those exhibition games as a means to recruit new players. The publicity guy would go ahead of the teams and put in the newspapers the games were going to be played, and anybody interested in trying out, come on such and such a date for a couple of hours. And they picked up some good players that way.
Well, do you have a favorite story of the league that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, gosh. One of the team bat girls, and she bat girl for South Bend, her name was Ruth Davis, and she just passed away last year. She served as bat girl for the Blue Sox in 1953 and 1954. And she said that she had earned a contract to play during the 55 season. And of course, that never transpired. And she said she cried almost all summer because she wasn't able to realize her dream to play professional baseball. But one of the things that she said about the league when I interviewed her was, she said, I grew up in an environment where I didn't know that I couldn't do anything because I was watching women play baseball and women weren't supposed to play baseball. And she said, I watched them become lawyers and doctors and professionals, and I realized that I could do anything that I wanted to do. She said, not only were they the best skilled women baseball players of the time, they were among the best people that this country had to offer. And as I've gotten to know the players, I have to concur with her. She said, you know, you can't say that across the board because there were some players that were mischievous and didn't follow the rules and that sort of thing. But she said, statistically, she'd say that was true of most of the players in the league, like Jean Fout giving me those binders.
Yeah,
I mean, she didn't have to do that. Dolly White, who played for Kenosha and Fort Wayne, she was president of the league. Well, I should back up a little bit. After I was able to go to the opening of the Women in Baseball display at the Hall of Fame in 88. In fact, I took time without pay to go to that. But after that, all of the reunions were held in the fall when hotel rates were cheaper and the players were all retired. So it was, you know, good for them. But I was teaching and coaching and couldn't go to the annual reunions that they started having. But when I retired in 2003, the first thing on my bucket list was to go to the next reunion, which that year was held in Syracuse, New York. Dolly White was the president of the Players Association at that time, and she was from Mobile, Alabama. And that's a story in itself. But anyway, she had occasion to read my thesis. And apparently, most of the members of the board at that time had read or had seen it. And so she encouraged me to try to get it published. That was the furthest thing from my mind. But one of the activities that reunion was to go to the Hall of Fame and revisit the Women in Baseball exhibit. While we were there, I talked to Tim Wiles, who at that time was research librarian at the Hall of Fame, and asked him, well, if I was going to submit my thesis to be published. Well, first of all, I gave the Hall of Fame a copy of my thesis. And then I asked him if I were to try to get it published, who would I send it to? And he gave me a couple of suggestions. So I checked them out. And McFarland Publishers at that time was doing a lot of women's history. And they've always done a lot of sport history. I thought, well, that sounds like a good match. And they agreed to publish it, with some revisions, which I was happy to do.
Can you tell us again the title of your book, Mary?
The title of my book is The Origins and History of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Sometimes you can get it on Amazon. If you look for it and can't find it, you can write to McFarland or call McFarland. If they don't have any in stock, they can print you up a copy within a week.
Cool.
And they're happy to do that. In fact, I order some from them every once in a while.
Well, send me that contact info and I'll put that on the notes as well.
Okay.
One thing I want to make sure too, I'll let you know. I know I was looking earlier today. It is available on Amazon in paperback and Kindle. For those of us who no longer have space on the shelves for our books. So kudos to you on that part too. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's got lots of good pictures in it too.
Well, that's good because it's my eyes get weaker. I need the photos as much as I do everything else. Oh, gosh. Tell me again, what's coming up again in Sarasota?
Sarasota is the second Women's Baseball Classic Tournament. Will feature the Kenosha Comets, the Racine Belles, the South Bend Blue Sox, and the Rockford Peaches.
Oh, man. I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, we got to talk that up, too, at the museum, the Tampa Baseball Museum. So, and I'll talk to Susan Pay. I think she's the lady who's facilitating all this.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's great. Well, I just want to say, I guess, one last thing. Is this team, this league, I think it would have fallen into anonymity if it wasn't for some of the things that you did. If Penny Marshall hadn't seen some of what was going on and then bringing it to. But it sounds, even if none of that had happened, the one thing that came from all of this were women who understood that they could do what they wanted. That it wasn't there weren't the restrictions, or there shouldn't be restrictions. And to me, that is a strong tale in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, that's a legacy of the war years, because women were thrust into working positions that had historically been reserved for men, and they did a fine job. They realized, just like in baseball. They did a fine job. They realized that they could do well at whatever they were assigned to do or wanted to do. And even though at the end of the war, they were encouraged to go back home, to let the men have their jobs back, to, go home and raise the kids and that sort of thing, most of them appreciated getting paid for the work they were doing.
Right.
and wanted to continue and appreciated the work. That was an important thing for them. And especially the gals who played baseball. Most of them, when the league folded, a fairly large number of them pursued professional golf, professional bowling, professional tennis, did well. Like Jean Fout became a professional bowler and did very well.
Well, again, that's encouraging. Again, I can't thank you enough, Mary, for joining us here today on Baseball Biz on Deck. Appreciate you sharing the tale, you know, of your own journey and bringing to light a sport many had forgotten, brought it to life for all of us. So with all that that's going on and seeing what Sue Zapay's doing in Sarasota, I'm excited about this. I got to tell you, a couple of years ago, I got re-engaged to watching softball with watching Oklahoma, FSU, University of South Florida, watching those teams. And to me, watching the athleticism, the tenacity that these women were putting out there on the field. And I found that fascinating because I got to tell you, it seems to be this way a lot of times in college and professional sports. I see grit. I see determination more there than I will sometimes at a professional level where I see with the men. So it's engaging. This has been fantastic, and I can't thank you enough.
Oh, my pleasure. I always enjoy sharing about the All-American League. Just one little tidbit. I became secretary of the Players Association in 2007, and I'm still working in that capacity.
Okay.
So I keep up on it.
Well, that's great. See, and to me, that's kind of fascinating in itself that there still is an organization in some capacity. Wow. Continue the good work.
Oh, thank you.
All right, Mary. Well, you take care, and I'll talk with you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Baseball Biz. As always, you can find us on your favorite podcast directory, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and more. Thanks again. And remember, you can also check us out on Twitter at TheBaseballBiz. Take care and have a great week. Special thanks to XTakeRUX for the music Rocking Forward.